Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 114.
Santa Nelia Toista.
That's Finnish.
Time is flying by. We're halfway through our run of Reflex already. Can you believe it?
No, it's really crazy. It feels like yesterday that Jay just got here, arrived to America from Sweden.
With 10 suitcases full of juggling equipment and props.
Yeah. I mean, at the start of every, creation, the start of Loden, I always am like, oh my God, is it going to be good? Like, is the show going to be good? You know? And you can think about something and have it in your head and talk about it and plan. And then until you have it in front of an audience, it's always like, is it going to be good? And that's also like my own self-doubt in myself, but I'm always like, is it going to be good? Is the audience going to love it? And like the reaction that Reflex has received thus far from the audience is so insane. It's so well-deserved. It's obvious. Like looking back, it's like, duh, of course it's good, but it's been so wonderful to see people, what they think they're going to see coming in. And then how they feel and what they've actually seen leaving.
For those of you who maybe are just tuning in for this episode or haven't heard us talk about Reflex before, real quickly, it's a new juggling show that we're doing in Brooklyn. It's been running since January 29th and is running through February 19th. The last week from February 14th to 19th is streaming online. So if you can't make it out to New York to see it, you can catch a digital live stream ticket. And it's really all about, it's about a few things. It's about space and it's about juggling and it's about art. And it's also just visual art in and of itself. It's performed and created by Jay Gilligan, who is a juggler, master teacher, visual artist, sound artist. And it was co-written and co-directed with Frodo Santini, who, if you don't already listen to his podcast, The Way of the Showman, you absolutely should. And he's just this amazing performer, director, writer in his own right, living in the variety and sideshow and magic worlds. And the combination of all of these elements of Jay's unique juggling and artistry combined with Frodo's storytelling and just flavor and style. And then, I think us doing it here in our backyard in New York City, and really smack dab in the middle of the kind of stuff we love to make, has really created this neat little show that has just been born and I think will have a long life. Having said that, I don't think we're going to stream it too much in the future. So even though maybe it will have future runs in New York or on tour elsewhere, if you want to catch it streaming, next week is probably the only week to do so.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to get the show in one spot where Frodo and Jay worked really hard on it for a year, basically writing, rewriting, and then they were only together in the same spot for about a week and a half. And, Jay would tape every rehearsal he did of the show with a few audience members, send it to all of us. We'd watch it. We'd give notes. We'd try something new. And then, arriving in New York into this space and then adding lighting and sound design and all the juggling machines, it's quite the special show.
How could I have left out the juggling machines in the description? The whole genesis for the show, and you may have heard this already if you've listened to all of our episodes, was that Jay has a machine that can juggle three balls with no sensory input, no cameras, no nothing. And that was where he originally got the idea for his one-man show or for Reflex. The machines all look spectacular.
Yeah, I think one thing also that's interesting is like my instinct for lighting. I feel like I should have Jay come on and we can like chat about folk circus lighting and kind of, my style of lighting, which is I really feel like I've kind of come to a style of lights that I really like in a show. And you do too, but I am like obsessive over them a little bit. And it's very much over lights. Like it's like a lot of lights and it's a lot of cues and it's a lot of amplification. And, Jay also comes from this world of just like a light, and like having it be the light and it being very artistic as well. And I kind of want to have like, we should have like a lighting discussion. We should have our lighting designer on.
We could do a whole podcast postmortem of, all the things, how we thought New York went and, the things that can be improved upon for future runs. But I'm so proud of where it's at, and I'm really just thrilled with the people who've come. Thank you to all of you who've already been in the first 2 weeks and said hello. Lindsay and I are at pretty much every show. Jay is obviously at every show, but it's really great hearing you guys come up and tell us what you thought. So get your tickets. You got 2 more weeks to see it in person. You can get them at reflexshow.com, and you got 1 week to catch a digital live stream. There's multiple show times for the live stream, so depending on what time zone you're in, there should be one that works well for you.
One thing I found during Reflex is there's quite the juggling community, which, like, duh, there is. But I've never been a part of it. And, you know, it's so embarrassing, but I still can only, you know, do like 2 passes of a 3-ball cascade, which, you know, now I know.
Yeah, but you don't practice. It's not like you've been trying and you can't. You just straight up don't practice.
It's true. I just have no interest in juggling. But yeah, the juggling community and the people in the community of jugglers and the people pushing the boundaries of juggling and kind of inventing different things is so interesting to me. And learning, you know, there's a part in Jay's show and Reflex that has these shaker balls, and they're so fun and cool because it also has a musical quality to it. And, you know, I met one of the jugglers who is currently in Absinthe who helped with the patterns of the shaker balls. And it's like, oh, wow, that's so cool. Like, this juggler helped you with a pattern for a juggling sequence for your show. And there's like a lot of little things like that where there's a lot of people's influence of juggling in the show. And, you know, you can learn the broad history, but they're like these little microcosms of different styles of juggling, different styles of juggling props, and like who does what has been so fascinating to me.
Yeah, well, I stand in the lobby every show before and after every performance. And every day there's either a famous magician, famous juggler, somebody important in the circus variety world who's coming to every show. And, you know, a decent amount of them I know, not so many the jugglers, though. And I'm like, oh, there's that juggler. Oh, and that juggler. And it's, you know, I think the community really supports it. E-Juggle Magazine wrote us a really nice review. I think it ended with, I'm paraphrasing it, but something along the lines of, I went in to go see a juggling show and I left realizing I don't even know what juggling is at all.
Well, that's the question, right? It's like, what is juggling and what are the constraints of juggling? And you know, I think if you're a person who doesn't particularly like juggling or doesn't even have any interest in circus generally, I'm always so interested to see what the people who are like that have as a reaction when they're leaving. And they're like, I had no idea what to expect from a juggling show. And it's so much more. And it's so much more than a juggling show. And it is. But like, obviously, the crux of it is juggling. And the audience that I didn't foresee also being, I don't know, in line with a juggling show is the magic world. And we've had a lot of magicians in, like Derek Delgadio, who wrote a show and was in the show called In and of Itself, which was off Broadway for about 2 years. It's on Hulu. I think it's moving to Disney Plus. We saw it. He also had a 2-man show before that called Nothing to Hide in New York. And he was a huge influence on this show just because of the style of talking and doing magic and kind of,
I think his style of magic and storytelling just really resonated with Jay, and you can see it in this show. It's a similar idea where you're using juggling and you're doing storytelling about your life and also about juggling.
Yeah, and having him come and see the show and love it was, I think, a huge moment for all of us, especially for Jay and Frodo, who've been, like, you know, working and writing for so long. But yeah, having the magic world, and it is so close to juggling in a very weird way.
Well, in a historical way.
Right, in a historical way. Wait, let me see if I can get this. In the medieval times, jugglers were expected to do a juggling trick, a backflip, a magic trip, a magic trick, play the flute, and anything else? Something like that. But it derived from the same person doing juggling and magic, and then it became two separate art forms.
Yes, well, they're almost like two sides of the same coin. They're object manipulation, and one is hidden and you're not meant to see the method at all. It's meant to be disguised, and the other is meant to be very realistic and you see it and be impressed by the method. So yeah, they're like brothers or sisters or cousins or something. So it shouldn't be surprising that their audience, the audience for magic shows and the audience for juggling shows is actually kind of similar, and not and seems obvious in retrospect, but surprised us certainly.
And I feel like after watching the show and just learning about the juggling scene, I have a more full picture of the world as it relates to juggling.
And not to like oversell it, but you know, you really, like Lindsay said, don't need to care at all about juggling or circus. Granted, you probably do if you're listening to this podcast, but it can, so long as you have a passion, that's really what it's about. It's about going as deep and as creatively as you can into whatever your passion or hobby is, and how it can change your life having a relationship with an art form that you love and you really just commit your whole self to.
Isn't that an awesome thing though, to have something in your life that you're so obsessed with and like in love with that you want to continue to learn about and continue to grow and live life through learning about that thing that you just love so much?
And maybe you just have already seen Reflex since maybe you come the first 2 weeks. And if you feel like, oh man, I can't get enough of Jay and those ideas, Jay also does have a podcast called Object Episodes, which is basically it's with Eric Obery, who's an amazing juggler and thinker. And I think they have like 20 hours at least of just them discussing juggling history. So if the show wasn't enough for you, you can get it on Object Episodes as well.
Before we were working on Reflex, and before we remounted our dance show off Broadway, we were working on a show upstate, mainly, well, in the Northeast, called Stars Above, and we toured around the Northeast of America. And one of the places we went was Ithaca, and it was one of my favorite places because we had the most amazing partner, Circus Culture.
And I want to give a shout out to Circus Culture because they have a call for submissions out for New York State circus artists. They're offering a fully funded week-long residency for individual circus artists based in New York and or Indian nations based therein. The residency would be April 18th to 24th. Ithaca really had a great vibe. Circus Culture studios and spaces are beautiful, well-maintained, really good creation and workout environments. So,
you know, I was thinking back to Circus Culture actually the other day because our son, Cyrus, who's 18 months, he learned to walk while we were on tour, but he learned to stand up by himself on the mats at Circus Culture while a show was happening. I had to go find toilet paper for the bathroom and I brought him with me. And he was running around the circus mat and he fell down, which great. It's so soft. And then I was like, you can see if you can get up by yourself. And he got up by himself. And that's like a huge milestone in the development of a baby. And so I'll always have that memory with Circus Culture of being this wonderful space, doing a show. And then, you know, my baby having a lifelong developmental moment. Yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll have your developmental moment there. I believe applications are due February 15th, and you can find out more information at circusculture.org/residency. And speaking of other presenters we had for Stars Above this past summer, I also want to give a quick shout out to NECA. That's the New England Center for Circus Arts. They have their upcoming Circus Spectacular, which is their annual fundraiser. If you're interested in supporting one of the best circus schools in the U.S., certainly the most in demand in the Northeast, and they were really enablers and helped us make our show Stars Above. We created it there as part of their company residence program. Go check them out, NECA.org. Go support their Circus Spectacular.
Yeah, NECA's great. Their facilities are amazing and the people who work there are just wonderful. And Cyrus started walking there. So a lot of memories with great people. So for today's podcast, I am nowhere to be found. I had pregnancy brain and misscheduled when our babysitter and our wonderful friend and assistant of life, Quinn, was coming. And I had her come like about an hour late. So I was on Cyrus duty and Josh took on this episode and I'm jealous.
So today I interviewed Bruce Hawley, who is the president of the Circus Historical Society, board member of Circus Fans of America, and is just a general expert on circus history and circus culture. And Bruce himself is not a circus performer or producer. He was actually in the military and worked in law, but he's been a circus fan his entire life and knows more about circus culture and circus history and how logistics and business work than many of our guests. And he told many stories and anecdotes that I actually hadn't heard before that were new to me. And I think if you're a circus history nerd at all, this is going to be a great episode for you. And if you're just curious about what these other organizations are in America that you can join, whether it's being a fan or somebody interested in history. I believe he mentioned one about music as well. You can find, you know, these different communities of people to discuss circus with. And I'm a member of the Circus Historical Society. I think it's a wonderful organization that more folks should know about. And Bruce and I do get into that near the end.
So that's what I'm talking about. Being so interested in something that you are obsessed with learning about it and talking about it and continuing your life through it. It's so cool. It's so awesome to have something that you're so into, you know, like, I don't know, people who are like, what should I do as a hobby? Like, maybe I'll take up, I don't know, painting or something.
Surfing,
I think, is a legit hobby where you have to dedicate. You have to get up early, have the right wetsuit, know where to go, look at the waves. Like, that's a whole thing. But some of my friends are like, what should I do? Like, I feel like I need a hobby. Like, maybe I'll join a wine club. But like, it's
so the so hobby awesome. Is drinking.
It's so awesome.
Yes, we recommend surfing over drinking, but whatever floats your boat. And hopefully this episode will be for you.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Here is our episode with Bruce.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you. Where am I reaching you at the moment?
I'm actually at home in Connecticut, and I live in Stratford, Connecticut, which is, as you know, right outside of New York City.
Are you originally a Connecticutian?
That's a good way to put it. Yes. In fact, my wife and I are both descendants of the original 19 families that settled the town in 1639. So we have long, long roots here. I grew up here, went to school here. Of course, I left when I went to college and law school and later into the Air Force. But we returned home to Stratford when we were done. And I think I might have mentioned to you, I'm actually related to P.T. Barnum, a distant cousin. So we have lots of connections here, both historically and actually into the circus world, too.
How did you discover you were related to him?
Well, I didn't know for many years until my daughter was doing an Ancestry.com genealogy. And she said, Dad, you're not going to believe this. We're actually, you know, you've always been interested in the circus. Now you know why.
Because it's in your genes.
But, yeah, I guess so. As we, you know, we always like to say sawdust in your veins, right? So, yeah. And of course, Barnum was related to Tom Thumb. So I guess I'm related to Tom Thumb, too. So lots of history here.
Did you see a lot of circuses? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that this particular area, you know, historically was very important in circus history. You know, in the 1800s, a lot of the circuses were based around the New York City area. In Somers, New York, as you may know, is where they had there were several menageries that were based there, traveling menageries, traveling zoos. And in Connecticut, you know, P.T. Barnum was actually born in Connecticut, in Bethel, Connecticut, near Danbury. And he was a museum guy, ultimately, and worked in and out of New York City. But, you know, later in his career, in his retirement job, he got into the circus business because he was 60 by the time he hit the circus world. Of course, he had great success before that as a museum operator and a promoter of Jenny Lind, and Tom Thumb, and Lavinia Warren, and so on and so forth. You know, the circus really came late in his life. And he was based in Bridgeport. He had his home here, several homes here. And of course, the winter quarters of the Barnum and Bailey Circus was here for almost 50 years, from around 1882 up to 1927. So lots of history. My great grandfather worked in the winter quarters as a wheelwright. I think he actually worked on many of the famous bandwagons that you see from time to time. The Two Hemispheres bandwagon, for example, was here during the period that he worked in the winter quarters. And he sort of came on when the show was going to Europe. You know, they wanted it to be the greatest show on earth, so they had to get out of travel, and they actually went to Europe for 5 years in the late 1800s. And before they left, they had to adjust all the heights of the wagons, and my great grandfather was hired to work on that, and they redid the wagon wheels, made them a little bit shorter, and took off the skyboards and had them fold down and things like that. So he was involved in all that, and that was all done in Bridgeport. And then later on, my great uncles, my grandfather, were acrobats, and they were performers. And in those days, they worked in the circus in the summer and vaudeville in the winter. And they were all based in this area too. So lots of connections to the circus, to this particular area.
Did you see many circuses coming through Stratford when you were growing up?
Yes, they came through Bridgeport, not so much Stratford, but in Bridgeport. You know, Bridgeport is the largest city in Connecticut, so it's a bigger venue. Interestingly, one of the gifts that Barnum gave to the city of Bridgeport was Seaside Park. And it's a beautiful park right along the shore. It was actually designed by Olmsted, who did Central Park in New York City, arches and so on and so forth. Very, very, very nice. And part of that park is a giant circus lot, which is where, you know, Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus performed up to 1956. In fact, they were on that lot about 6 weeks before they folded under canvas in Pittsburgh. So, saw lots of circuses there. And then later on, you know, Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus was there and other smaller shows. But in this area, certainly, and then, of course, more recently, Bridgeport has an arena. And before Ringling Brothers closed, Bridgeport was always on the route to come to do at least a week in Bridgeport. So I saw them many times in the arena as well.
And you never felt like, oh man, I got to learn some juggling or acrobatics and run away with one of these shows?
Well, of course. And, coming from, a circus background family, we did have a trapeze in the backyard. We did have a wire in a backyard. So we had that component, and, you know, it was high enough to get hurt, not killed, but still get hurt. And, but people would say, what kind of family is that with all this cable and the rigging that we had all over the place? But, as part of growing up in this kind of a family, we knew how to work with turnbuckles and come-alongs and the cable clamps and so on and so forth. So yes, we had that too.
But it appears you pursued a more traditional life, going to law school and joining the military. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And did circus at all interweave in surprising ways in either of those career paths?
Yes, it certainly did. I'm 72, so I'm of the Vietnam era. And when I was 18 in college, the Vietnam War was going, and we had to register for the draft, and they were drafting. So when I got into college, I joined the Air Force ROTC program, actually at Fordham. And when I graduated from college in 71, I was commissioned in the Air Force, and the war was going. So a lot of folks my age, men my age, had a connection to the military because of the draft and the Vietnam War. And so fortunately, I got into law school. The Air Force let me go to law school. I was on technically what's called an educational delay. And then when I graduated from law school, I passed the bar, and then I came on active duty as a captain. And I was a judge advocate. There used to be a TV show, JAG, Judge Advocate General is what JAG stands for. And, I was doing courts martial and all of those kinds of things you would expect as a lawyer who handles litigation for the Air Force, criminal litigation. And then over time, I transferred around the country, ended up in Europe. I mean, one of the nice things about being in the service is you live in different places. And if you have a hobby like the circus, you always take advantage of going to see circuses. And I particularly enjoyed when I lived in Europe, seeing the German circuses. That was quite fascinating. And I saw, the ones that were famous in the 70s and early 80s. And it was interesting to see a different perspective. And then I stayed in the Air Force for quite a while, and then I went into the reserves. I didn't stay the entire time on active duty. I switched early 80s to the reserves. And then I pursued a separate career, a parallel career, really, in law, and practice in private practice at first, and then later on in corporate law. And I ended up working in an industry where I, you know, moved up the ranks and had an opportunity to, you know, have national responsibility and to travel a little bit in that job too. So, and then finally in 2005, I retired from the Air Force as a Brigadier General to 34 years. And then I stayed on in the corporate world until 2017. So it was nice to have jobs where you got to travel around and see things. And of course, you'd always sneak off and see a circus if you could.
What, you know, this is maybe kind of a naive question to ask, but prior to the internet, when you're looking for fellow hobbyists or, you know, you find people who have a similar passion for circus, how did you connect with people? I mean, granted, I know there were a fair number of magazines that existed at the time that don't exist now, but I'm curious to learn about how, say, like prior to the 2000s, what it was like to be a circus fan or hobbyist and what that community was like.
Well, that's a terrific segue into these organizations. You know, there have been circus fan groups, history groups, music groups, which serve that very purpose. You know, the Circus Fans Association, and I'm on the board of directors of the CFA as well, and the National Circus Preservation Society, which are sort of sister organizations related to each other. That started first in the 1920s. And when I was old enough to become a member, and in those days, I think you had to be 18, but my grandfather and my father were in, and I certainly got the magazine and knew what was happening there. And I also would go to the newsstand on the corner and pick up Amusement Business, which is the weekly magazine that had the Roots in it, Circus Roots. And so, you know, if you're interested in the hobby, you can find out where circuses are, what's happening. But the magazine, you know, provided that. And in those days, they published a directory with phone numbers and addresses and no email, of course. And if you were traveling around, you could reach out to people sort of the old fashioned way by phone and or by letters. And then the Circus Historical Society, that was started a little bit later, I think 1939, which I'm president of now. And that focused primarily on the history of the circus, as the name implies. The fans were a club and really about contemporary circus and supporting what's happening today. The Historical Society is what happened in the past, you know, so they have a separate mission, separate organizations, different parts of the, or they're not related to each other at all. They're just separate organizations. And then the Windjammers are musicians, and I'm a member of that as well. I put myself through college and law school as a musician. So, you know, I always had an interest in circus music as well. So I joined that group. So I
did
was
I
never
see a
in
photo
the
of you playing percussion? Was your instrument drums and percussion?
Yeah, drums. And I was I can sing, and I was a lead singer. So through college, one of the nice things about being someone who could sing and play an instrument is you always had a gig. You know, I worked primarily in the New York City area, and then later in Detroit. And, I was a singing drummer, not too many of those, and so always had work, which was good. You know, but the Windjammers is the musical part of the group and this of the various organizations that are out there. And then the last big group is the Model Builders. And these are folks who are very similar to model train enthusiasts. They build the circus models. And although I did build a circus model when I was a kid, I didn't really join that organization. I'm certainly aware of it and what it does. But there is something for everyone. I mean, quite candidly, that's one of the nice things about these groups that are out there is there's something for everyone who has an interest in some aspect of the circus. So, and that's how we did it before the internet. And today we do it through Facebook and the way we're doing it right now. But the thing is that's constant. And this really amazes me, particularly in the position I'm in right now, because I get all the emails, you know, that are directed to the head of the organization. People are passionate about this. You know, it's almost an emotional tie to it. And it's quite interesting to see what triggers that passion in the circus. And, you know, there's something for everyone. There's people who are focused on the logistics. All they care about is how quickly did they get it loaded into town, and they never watch the performance, but they're all about the logistics of the circus. and particularly the wagons. That was always a big thing. And then there are folks that all they cared about was the music. And then the ones that just love the performance, you know, and I think the common thread to all of it is, I like to describe it this way, but I kind of think it's true, is sort of the movement and the gypsy lifestyle and the fact that it's here today, gone tomorrow. That appeals to, it seems to be the common thread of all the different interests that are part of the circus. And of course, I think the fact that it's live is a big thing too. And I think particularly right now, there's a huge demand for live entertainment. So it all kind of rolls together.
It's an interesting juxtaposition of having such an ephemeral art form with a historical society trying to document this, you know, hard to grab onto. Certainly not like music, where you can look at sheet music, or a play where you can look at old text. It has its own weird nuances of documenting it. Yeah. One thing, as you were speaking, that I was curious, have you seen like a change in the number of people who are interested in being part of these organizations? Has it gone up or down during time? Are people now asking, how does Cirque du Soleil travel instead of Ringling? Are the focus of the questions, have they changed over time, or is it mostly a certain generation of people who have this passion, who remember a certain era in particular?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is yes to all of it. There are a lot of people who are very interested, particularly the historical society in the past. And quite candidly, and I think it's true of any history group, they tend to be people who are, say, over 60. And with the circus, it's a tie to their youth. It's a tie to a time when, you know, things were, you know, fun, and they're interested in that. So I think in the historical society, I know our demographics are such that we do have a great number of people who are over 60, and surprisingly a great number that are over 80. And what's interesting is the longevity of these people. A lot of these members of our group lived into their 90s. And you know, we see the obituaries, and you hear about people passing and stuff like that. And I think quite candidly, one of the secrets to longevity is this interest in the circus and in this hobby that they have. And again, I'm talking about the hobbies. We also in the historical society have a great number of circus professionals, particularly performers, but also owners and producers and directors who come to us because they want to hear about what sometimes they're the subject of some of these talks. As you know, we talked with Wayne McCary. He's on the board of directors, and he was and is a producer for many, many years. So there's that integration of the older fans and the older performers and professionals that flock to, say, the historical society. We also are having a growing demographic of young women in the historical society. There's no question. In fact, in our recent board election, we added several young women who are interested in it. They have different interests. They're not so focused on the logistics and the wagons, but they're focused on the art form. And that's so important because all this, obviously we said earlier, goes together. And we're so pleased that we have so many younger people who have the time, and these are people in their 30s and 40s who are willing to step up into leadership positions in these organizations and help us adapt to what's happening. The fans have sort of a similar setup, and I think the other groups do too, as far as the demographics. But one thing about the fans is they usually attract more of the youth circus folks, you know, who are, and there, as you know, there are many youth circuses out there. In 2015, we did, I was with the Circus Fans Association, and I was co-chair of the Worldwide Circus Summit. And this was a gathering of all the different groups. And we had pretty close to 1,000 people attend this week-long event in Massachusetts, in Springfield. And that was a unique event, which brought all of the fan groups together, all of the professional groups. There were many circus schools there. As you may know, Circus Smirkus was nearby, and that was an additional option. We had Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus, which actually it was Cole Brothers at the time, which unfortunately has since closed. Ringling Clown College had auditions there. I mean, it was truly a gathering of folks, and we had people from Europe. I went to Europe to meet with the folks at the Fédération Mondiale du Cirque, and their executive director came, and the head of the European Circus Association came. So it was a nice gathering of folks from particularly Europe and North America for a week to talk about all things circus. And we documented it. We actually have a video of the whole thing, all the different programs and activities. Jonathan Lee Iverson, the ringmaster with Ringling Brothers, opened the program. He flew in from Houston specifically to just do the opening speech. So we had tremendous support, particularly from the Feld organization, and Johnny Pugh with Cole Brothers, and so on and so forth. A lot of the major schools. So it was a great gathering.
So a little bit of a switch, and I'm putting you on the spot for a history question. So if you don't want to answer it, you don't have to. But one thing that happened when coronavirus sort of became a thing back in the beginning of 2020 is I started trying to research what happened to circuses during the 1918 flu, and if there would be any trends that repeated themselves. You know, one thing I noticed was it also timed with Ringling, Barnum, and Bailey consolidating into one show. But I'm wondering, given your interest in circus history and where we are at the moment, if you're seeing sort of any historical echoes in today's circus environment.
Well, sure, absolutely. And as you know, you're absolutely correct. You had the end of World War I and you had the pandemic. So you had two big things happening, which caused Ringling Brothers to make some major adjustments, but all the circuses did. In fact, they closed their season early to get back to Bridgeport. And particularly in those days, they were touring two shows. There was Ringling Brothers was separate from Barnum and Bailey, and so they had to make adjustments in the business and the route because of the pandemic. I think after that, there was a sort of a hiatus, just as we kind of had, I think, in the circus world the last, I guess, year and a half, 18 months in particular. And then it blossomed into what became the golden age of the circus. You know, so what happened in the 20s, you know, came after what happened with the pandemic and the end of World War I, and grew the circus into a whole different level, I think, than it was before that. What I think is happening right now, from what I can see and talking to a lot of folks, and even what you folks are doing with your show, is one, people are tired of looking at computer screens. They want to see live entertainment. There's that mystery of someone could get hurt, someone could get killed, but also this is beautiful. This is artistry. You know, there's that drama, if you will, that you don't have in a recorded situation or a movie or whatever, and people really enjoy that. Interestingly, and I'm sure you know, a lot of circuses are actually reporting very good business. I attended Hermanos Vazquez in the Bronx in November when they were there, and I went on a Friday night. It was packed, you know, and this is in the middle of the pandemic. A lot of folks have come out for that. That show is actually spun off a separate show, Flip Circus, which is going to be in New Jersey in March. In fact, I think they're actually in South Jersey right now, but they're going to play in this area, the New York City area. Out west, there's a lot of small shows. They just adapt, to the circumstances. And Garden Brothers Circus recently spent a lot of money. Buy a brand new big tent. The Vernardo Circus, they're successful. It's a small show. It's 500 seats, something like that. They're moving around. They're on the road. They've adjusted, and that's the beauty of this. You know, we obviously circuses have had to deal with the change in movement away from animals, large animals, and exotic animals, and the show's adapted. They just adapted, and I think, there were parallels to what happened after the pandemic in 1918 as well. That brought us to the golden age of the circus. So I'm hopeful that we're about to reach another golden age of the circus, with different ideas, different approaches to things. So I'm very optimistic. I think things are going to be good. And I listened to Wayne McCary's podcast, and I think you asked him if you were, if he was younger, would you do it over again? And he said, absolutely, yes. And I talked to a lot of producers and people who were investing in this, and they're saying exactly the same thing. You know, they got knocked down. Certainly people were economically affected by the shutdown, if you will. But that has triggered, I think, some creativity, and which is a nice thing about the arts anyways, in my view, keeps you going. And that's encouraging. And I'm optimistic we're going to see another golden age in the next few years.
So one thing, going back to the Wayne episode, that he sort of spoke on was how there's a lot less, or he feels there's a lot less high quality performers available in the U.S. to the degree it was maybe in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Have you seen any trends, you would say, either away from certain acts or towards certain kinds? Certainly when I look at these historical photos and video clips, particularly of Ringling, there are things you never see anymore, such as like an aerial ladder act, or other just kind of even skywalk, which is when people are hanging and walking through footloops, have starting to disappear a little bit. And I don't know, have you noticed any trends along those lines?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think before we talk specifically about the acts, the big trend is the movement away from the family business. You know, circuses for many years were family businesses. And in fact, circus artists often talk about, I'm fourth generation, I'm seventh generation, I'm eighth generation. That trend has gone away. There aren't that many, quite candidly, people who are maybe of the sixth or seventh generation that their children are going into the business, you know? So that's a little bit of a difference, because if it's a family business, like any other family business, whether it's a car dealership or a bottling company, it's all the same dynamics that are involved. If this was your grandparents or your mother's, or your father's business, and assume that you're going to take over, you approach things differently. You know, you have within your family, the, corporate knowledge of what worked 30, 40, 50 years ago that affects what you're going to do. And quite candidly, many of them have their own equipment. Well, I still have my poles that I used, you know, in the 1950s. Like we could use those. And I think that, and they know what acts were popular. We recently had one of our board members, Anya Norris, Anya Murphy Norris, she was interested in the Iron Jaw acts, and she did an article about that, and you may have read it in our journal, The Bandwagon. And you know, that was a popular thing in the 1920s, you know, it was the Iron Jaw act, and it was repeated later on. You know, Becky Ostroff, who is an aerialist, she actually did it in the movie Water for Elephants, in the opening sequence of the film. It's her performing the Iron Jaw. And so there's an example where, okay, it worked in the 20s and then it went away. Now we're seeing it again, you know, and whether we're going to see it with the, you know, the butterfly costumes, which was part of that period, or something else. So I think absolutely, you know, and I think people who are in the business, and I found this to be interesting. We were talking about maybe having some kind of a trade show where we would have people who, you know, build trapeze equipment and stuff like that, like you would have a commercial trade show. And I talked to some circus artists, and they say, you know, we do our own thing. We do our own welding. We do our own costume work. We do our own design. And if you're from a family where this is your many multiple generations, where you have the equipment, everybody knows how to do some welding, basic welding and stuff like that, you know, you can design things on the spot, on the road even, to make it happen, as opposed to going through a catalog or a website looking for a lira or a German wheel or whatever what you want to do. So I think there's the trend, is the going away from the families to what has substituted for that, quite candidly, are the circus schools. You know, and in Europe, and there's a long tradition, particularly in Eastern Bloc countries, where they had state-sponsored circus schools. And I quite honestly think that ramped up the level of quality of many acts acrobatic acts, tumbling trapeze, you know, the flying cranes. You go down the list of all these great acts that were different that came out of those Eastern Bloc schools. And as you know, in the United States, you know, we now have second generation of circus schools that are out there, and they're producing people. Some are doing it for recreation purposes. Certainly, that's great. Just as you would for a dance. I have granddaughters, I had daughters who took dance lessons. They didn't become prima ballerinas, but it was part of their growing up and learning the skills of dance. But more importantly, I think by taking lessons like that as a child, you get to appreciate the performer in the ring or the performer on stage, because you know what it takes to be on point, for example. And I think, so now what's happening is you have a more, in the United States, a more sophisticated audience that's going to see a Cirque du Soleil performance, and they're in their 20s and they're maybe their early 30s, and they're bringing their children. And maybe when they were 18, 19, they were in a circus school, or maybe they took web training somewhere for exercise. They appreciate what's happening much more. So it's like someone who is into the opera and took singing lessons and sang in a college choir, and they go see the opera. They fully get what's happening and they understand it. And I think that's a nice trend that is developing, is that we're making the audience a more sophisticated, let's put it that way, because of these schools. Plus, it's also a source of performers who choose to go on. I mean, Wesley Williams, the Unicycle Fellow, I'm sure you know him. He came out of Circus Marcus, and he's been all over the world. Unfortunately, he got hurt recently, but you know, he's a product. He's an example of someone coming out of the school. He's not fourth, fifth, sixth generation, but he's performing at the professional level, and he's entertaining, and he's doing what is needed to meet the need for live entertainment in this art form. So that's all good stuff.
You sort of raised two things that I think we've talked about a couple of times that I want to just throw back. So one, we're doing a juggling show right now with this juggler, Jay Gilligan. And one thing we've spoken about with him is how up until maybe the 2000s, all the jugglers basically had to make their own props or find people who were able to manufacture them. But like, you know, making your own lira or wheel of death or whatever, the artist would make their own juggling prop. And now everybody orders the same white ball, the same pink club from the same websites. And the challenge has changed for jugglers, where many jugglers don't even consider making the prop something that they would do. And now they're all trying to figure out, how do I do something new with this standardized prop, which was never the case before. And I think there is one, we spoke to Dolly Jacobs on the podcast. She talked about how the reason that circus is a folk art is because these things were passed down traditionally, how to make the costume, how to make the prop. And that I've definitely seen change. But I do wish prop making or something along those lines was taught in circus school, because I think we'd see a bit more variety in what people do. The other thing that you mentioned, and then feel free to respond to either sort of direction, was about how the circus schools are making the audience more sophisticated. When Lindsay and I went to Australia for about a month to do a show as part of a fringe festival, we noticed that many, many, many more people, at least per capita, had done youth circus camps and schools or after school activities as kids, and therefore as adults wanted to see that as a genre much more, just because of their exposure to it. And this is something I'm very hopeful about, the recreational circus scene in the U.S., because I think I do hear performers sort of lament the low level of skill, and it's being associated with yoga, and it's being associated with fitness and not artistry or whatever the higher value is. But I do agree it has certainly grown the audience, and I think it's a real step towards getting people back to being more interested in it once you're exposed and you realize, oh my gosh, this stuff is so difficult or so hard or so painful or whatever the reason is. But I definitely identify, or I feel like I've seen those two things myself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And back on the props, quite candidly, a lot of the prop manufacturers are circus performers who, for whatever reason, are not performing anymore. They have those skills. They know how to design, particularly rigging, and they don't perform anymore because of age or injury, but they know how to weld because that's what they learned, you know. So So there is that. And I totally agree. I think Cirque schools, in my view, should really have that component and also a history component. And one of the things that we're doing at the Circus Historical Society is we're developing a curriculum for circus history to be taught at various levels. And one of the things that is actually going really well right now, and this is of course a different demographic, is the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, which is OLLI, they call it. It's a many universities have these non-credit courses for senior citizens, essentially. And right now we've got some circus history courses being taught. There's a fellow named Lynn Duncan who teaches at Furman University. He's one of our members, and he does his class gets sold out, if you will, instantly. And he's been doing this for a number of years because there's people who are interested in the history of the circus. And these are older people, I get that. But one of the things we're really trying to focus on, particularly working with ICO and ACE and the circus organizations, is developing a circus history curriculum that could be taught in the circus schools. And maybe it has to be more segmented, the history of the trapeze, the history of the German wheel or whatever it is, and who the artists were and what they did and that kind of thing. And I think that would help the entire art form, just as you see in opera or dance or symphony and music and things like that. So that's why I'm optimistic that people now are talking to each other at these various levels, as opposed to, keeping for competitive reasons, hiding everything and staying away. And there's a tremendous amount of competition, certainly, in the industry. And I think that in the past kind of hurt it because people were being secretive. Nobody would let you take a picture or, heaven forbid, now bring your camera, turn it on, put it on social media, go for it. So, the context has changed dramatically, and circuses need to adjust to meet that need. That's, I think, basic in any business, and it is show business, but the cool thing about this is there's an emotion in it, and there's artistry in it, and there's, I always get into this discussion with my children about, does art influence life, or does life follow art? What's the chicken and the egg problem? But I think it's a little bit of both, and I do and have seen in my lifetime how people are influenced by music in particular. A great example is, the movie The Greatest Showman. Is it historically accurate? No. Is the spirit of it accurate? Absolutely. Because that's what Barnum was about. And the some of the music that came out of that, look at the song This Is Me. This thing, the American skaters danced at the last Olympics. And to This Is Me, because it's a positive message. It's all about, inclusion and things like that, which kind of Barnum was involved in, in a different way. You look at Tom Thumb and, that's sort of the, he had huge success. He was a great entertainer. He was different, but, he did well. He had a great life. Fortunately, he didn't live very long because of his physical situation, but he made a difference. People are still talking about him, and he's dead over 120 years. So I think that's what's unique about this particular art form, is it combines it. Personally, what I'd like to see, I was seeing a little bit of this, is the combining of music and circus, Cirque de la Symphonie, for example, and Cirque Musica, which were productions that particularly travel around Christmas time, holidays, provide circus acts with a full symphony. And it's a crossover audience. I've attended some of those performances. And it's interesting to see, a local symphony crowd audience mixed in with the circus folks and very high level circus acts with the symphony. And beautiful, beautiful productions. I saw one a couple of years ago, and it was in Bridgeport, and it combined with the Bridgeport Symphony, and one of the circus artists was a violinist, and part of the act, there was a soloist, a singer, who was singing, and they were on either side of the stage, and of course the orchestra was in the middle, and the audience didn't know what was going to happen, but they were both attached to mechanics, and as the music is going, the singer fully attached goes up, and she had a long dress that kind of went all the way down to the floor. You know, it was 20 feet long. You couldn't tell when she came out on stage the way they had it set. And the violinist did the same thing. So here you had these two women, one a violinist, soloist violinist, suspended above the orchestra, with the orchestra. It was circus. It was music. It was together. And it was inspirational, you know. And that's encouraging to see that.
Hmm. Yeah, you really have juxtaposed a very visual versus a very audio medium that I'm sure the combination of two is quite a special thing.
Yep.
One, going back to the Circus Historical Society and just history documentation in general, you know, of course, many people cite the beginning of circus being Philip Astley and, you know, the various progressions and then using the word circus a couple of years later into being into tents, into all the various stages that it went through in the last, say, 250 years. But prior to that specific window, quarter of a millennia window, you know, have you found a lot of documentation or a lot of interest in sort of the pre-circus being called circus timeline? You know, people say, oh, it goes all the way back to, you know, ancient Egypt, or it goes all the way back to Greece or however long. But that's quite a different, maybe it is or isn't. Do you find that to be a totally different topic or the same topic or of more or less interest to folks?
Well, it's part of the whole story, you know, and obviously in Rome, you have the Circus Maximus. I mean, it's there. I mean, the remains of it are there near the Colosseum. The focus there was more of a link between the horse and man, or people, humans. And that's, I mean, as you know, the circus ring is 42 feet in diameter, because that's what you need to have a full-size horse run a gallop. And so there was this combination of the animal and the circus. And I've always thought about this, and I had a professor in college who said this, and I thought it was interesting. He said, you know, the circus is the only art form where you see humans doing things that animals do, and animals doing things that people do. And so there was that link between particularly the horse, and but later on with other animals, to humans in that setting. And it's no surprise that, you know, Astley kind of started that way, but that's the long tradition going back. And you go back to, you know, medieval times where these small circuses in these villages where the horse was common to everything. Of course, that was a form of transportation back then, move the wagons and stuff. But people understood the animals and the relationship between a human and an animal and the communication and so on and so forth. But then, of course, you roll into the jester, and you roll into, which became the clown, and you roll into, you know, the juggler and the magician and the sorcerer but the two common threads were, of course, the horse, and then, of course, movement. You moved. You didn't stay in one place. You know, there's the gypsy aspect of it, which makes it exotic, which makes it, people think about, oh, what, they were here, now they're gone, and you know, there's all of that memory that comes from seeing something that's sort of ephemeral that keeps moving. And so I think there is definitely a common thread that goes all the way back. I think in Europe, there's a little more focus on that because that's where a lot of that happened. But, you know, the United States certainly has a tradition, you know, going back into the 1700s. And I think it's important for people to look at, like you said, use the pandemic as an example, but look at other things in Civil War. What do we do then? How did the circus get through the Civil War? How did the circus get through World War II? You know, and so on and so forth. Major social, economic changes. What did it do? And there are lessons, I think, that come from that. And it's nice to be part of an organization that has preserved that history. And it's there. You know, you can research it in our journals that go back to the late 30s. Great researched articles, footnotes, you know, first source, primary source documentation. That's what kind of makes it very interesting, and it's a great resource for people to do that.
You know, there's another circus organization that sprung up during the pandemic called the American Circus Alliance, and one of their focuses is getting circus to be recognized by the NEA in the same category as dance or theater or opera. which we've talked a lot about on the podcast, whether or not that's a good thing for Circus to be associated in this highbrow context. And for Lindsay and I, we don't run a nonprofit, so it's not even like we would be getting funding from the sure. NEA. But one of the things that I feel like I wish more people in that organization or in general who were looking for this government recognition for Circus would rely on would be the American circus history with the U.S. government, starting all the way with George Washington through to the term throwing your hat in the ring. And to me, what's so interesting about this advocacy is all of this history seems to have been lost amidst the want to be recognized as these other art forms. And I still feel like if we had these arguments and you went to your you know, state representative or the president or whomever, and you were like, look, this goes all the way back to the beginning with America, and that's why it's important, I think it might have a little bit more success than saying, no, we're like dance, or no, we're like opera, and therefore you should include us.
I'll give you a contemporary example of that. I'm on the board of the Barnum Museum, and we got national landmark status, and we had a little press conference, and you know, the politicians came naturally for that. And one of the things that they picked up on instantly is, you know, Barnum was a state senator. He was a representative. He was a politician too. He made it happen, and he did, you know. So there's actual real examples where people went in and out of that. My view of it is, and I think the American Circus Alliance is phenomenal. I'm a member. I think it's a great organization. There's two parts of it. I think one is, do you want the government to subsidize the circus? Is it just a funding source, that kind of thing? Because as you know, with anything like that, there's strings. Or do you want the government to make it easy for you to operate this art form? And probably the best example I could think of is in Europe, again, the Fédération Mondiale du Cirque had an initiative to build this circus connection with the European Union, so that it made it easier for circus artists to travel from country to country. You know, that's a practical thing, you know, where the government doesn't become an obstacle. And if it's encouraging the art form, they're not throwing roadblocks in the way. And in the United States, some good examples would be, and this is a tough one, but you know, permitting and standards for seating and standards for the tent. I mean, they're all over the lot. There is no, as far as I know, no national standard where you show up with one piece of paper that's good in every single town, every single county, every single state throughout the United States because of the way things go. So to the extent that the government could say at the national level, look, at these are the standards and you have to accept it. So you can't require that the exit lights be blue in one state and orange in another state and that kind of stuff. That's where I think the American Circus Alliance can really be helpful as far as getting government support to have standardization. And, you know, and the Federation came up with a standardization for safety. They have safety standards. They have an inspection thing where you get certified by qualified inspectors, and you get a certificate saying, you know, you complied. And when you roll into town, you show the certificate and they accept it instead of dealing with some local regulation or official that wants one thing or another. That's where I think the Alliance needs to work to support this because of its the fact that it moves. It's not like you're sitting in town for 50 years in the same building and having the relationships with the local folks. And I think that's where the work needs to be done. Is on that side.
That's a great response. I feel like another thing they could help with, just throwing out there, if you know, you folks were listening, is figuring out another visa besides the O-1 or the P-1 that makes it a little easier to bring in performers for the right length of contract. Exactly. would be my wish. Given that you're currently the president of the Circus Historical Society, I'm wondering if you'd give me or our listeners like a little pitch of why they should join and you know, what they get with their membership for those who maybe don't know.
Well, thank you. Of course, the main thing is you get the journal. And this is the current issue of the Bandwagon. It's a 100-page journal with high quality graphics and layout. And it's a quarterly professional journal. Many universities subscribe to it. You can see it in public libraries around the country. we, you know, for $60 a year, that covers the, you know, that's to support our work in this. And we're a volunteer organization. All the writers, you know, they do these articles pro bono, as we say in the legal world. But we have obviously cost in editing and layout and print and mailing and things and so on and so forth. The other major thing is our annual convention, which is going to be actually in the New York City area. It's going to be in Bridgeport, Connecticut, because of the Barnum Museum. And that'll be this summer in July. We gather from folks from all over the country. And recently, we're going to have folks from even Australia and other parts of the world zooming in for part of it. But the main part, of course, is the live gathering. And the convention is 2 or 3 days. It's speakers on various topics. It's done more of an academic style where you have short presentations on particular topics, papers, if you will, presented, and where people can, it's more of an academic setting in that regard. But there's fun too. We have an opening reception. We have, we'll have a tour of the Barnum Museum. We're actually gonna do a tour of grave sites of Barnum and Tom Thumb and see some of the places where the winter quarters was in Bridgeport. And hopefully we'll be visiting a circus that we hope to be nearby, but I can't really announce it because they haven't confirmed yet. And we probably will go to Hartford for the Hartford Circus Fire site, which isn't too far from where we're going to be, the 1944 Circus Fire. There's a memorial there. So that's the convention. The other part is we have once a month Circus History Live. It's a Zoom program. In fact, I just released last night. We're doing this month, February is Black History Month, and we're going to celebrate Black history with four legends. Jonathan Lee Iverson, a famous first African-American ringmaster with Ringling Brothers, also a New Yorker, and Vanessa Thomas Smith, who was first African-American female ringmaster with Big Apple Circus, actually, another tie to New York. Denise Payne, first African-American female graduate of Clown College. And Denise has done great work too. And then Kip Jones, who is with Kim Anthony Kip Jones, who was with King Charles Troupe, who is currently director in the King Charles Troupe, also part of Ringling, but you know, big success for a lot of folks, the unicycle basketball act that's been around for, I guess they're in their fifth, they call it the fifth generation, but you know, the groups as they move on, as they get older. But a great program. We're looking forward to that. That's gonna be the 20th of February, and that's free. We have members and non-members attend that. But we've done several programs. We've done one about trains, which was very popular, the Ringling Train. We had train masters on. We had one of particularly acts, the Harriet family, Heidi Harriet, and her sisters, or four sisters who were descendants of John Harriet. I think it was Ruth Harriet, the Harriet family, a wonderful program, very well attended. We had one on film, circus film. Someone found a 1912 film of Ringling Brothers and they restored it. It was a film organization that restored it. And we showed that, and it was very, very popular. It was a circus parade, actually. And people enjoyed that. So we have a lot of things. We have one on clowns, David Carlyon. Did one on clowns. So just about every aspect of the circus. So that's a nice way to stay tuned once a month, free online. And that's part of the Circus Historical Society. That's basically, we have a auction. So people sometimes like to buy, particularly posters, that's a popular thing. We do have fundraising auctions and stuff too. But that's the Historical Society, and for $60 a year, it's a great organization to be part of. As I mentioned earlier, it's been around since the late 30s, and some very nice people, great ideas, often very, very helpful to share. We have a message board, which we call the Jackpot Junction, and jackpots are sort of circus people talking about things, and behind the scenes or backstage, if you will, that's where that jackpot comes from. Telling stories, sometimes exaggerating, but just a funny term. Anyways, it's a message board, and you know, people put up a question or doing research on something, and you'd be surprised the answers that come in. Recently, we've had a whole bunch of questions about Victorian and Edwardian female circus costumes. And we had people come right back with, oh yeah, I know we can get that. And there's one over here, and there's a museum that's got this. And these are people who are interested in that. And they're doing theses on costumes, you know, whether it's a master's or a doctorate degree. So you never know what is going to attract that. The other part I think that we appeal to is people who are interested in ancestry. Their uncle, their great uncle, their grandfather, their mother, whatever, was rumored to be a circus performer in the 1920s. Is it true? And we get lots of requests. How do I find that out? How do I figure that out? They're doing their ancestry.com and they get to that city directory where they list their occupation and they say, you know, trapeze artist and or juggler. And they say, what? I didn't know that. And the next thing you know, they're looking at our website trying to figure out, you know, whether their great-great-grandfather was part of the circus. And what did he do? What did she do? So we do get that interest as well. So again, it's a fun group, interesting to study history and a little bit of the arts, but also the, you know, logistics and things and so on and so forth.
One more thing you didn't mention that I really like about at least the website that you guys have is a thing called The Backyard, where if you're somebody who is really into circus books or movies, or people know who listen to this, what one of the coming up questions is going to be, that's one of my favorite places to find resources. It's basically like one page with a collection of some of the best circus history books and DVDs and yep. collections of things at a very reasonable price, certainly considered what you might find on like Amazon or one of the more normal booksellers. So sure. That's also worth checking out, I think.
Yeah, thank you. And these are donations, and people donate their collections and because they want to share, you know, what they have. And that's nice because, you know, sadly, when people die, you know, say, what are we going to do with grandpa's books? what are we going to do with his posters? And fortunately, people do donate them, and that's helps us with our mission as well. So, and it's sharing of information, which is fun. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Bruce, I'd like to ask you the same three questions that we ask all of our guests when we're wrapping up. And the first one doesn't have to be totally circus related, but feel free to answer it that way if you like. Has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that somebody has given you and stuck with you?
It's interesting. Well, you know, to be candid, I've been blessed that I have been around people who I think did the right thing and gave me good advice. And everybody, you know, as you go through life, you want to make sure you don't make mistakes. And I can't think of anybody who gave me bad advice. And that may sound like an odd question, but or an odd answer, I should say. But it's true. I've been very, very fortunate to be surrounded by people who are grounded and who see how things affect others. The good advice is, you know, don't be selfish. Don't be focused on yourself. Don't be focused on that. Think of others. And those are really important things, because if you're more focused on what you're doing, the organization, whatever, you get much better results, and honestly, it's easier to live that way, in my view, because you're not worrying about yourself, you're worrying about your mission, if you will. In the Air Force, we have what we call core values, and this is tough to live by, but in service, it's important. And everybody who's in the Air Force knows this. It's integrity first. You know, be honest with yourself, be honest with others, do the right thing, have the right stuff. The second one is tough, service before self, the needs of the organization instead of, you know, the needs of your own personal needs. And people, you know, tend to worry about themselves. Certainly you want to survive and take care of your family and whatnot. But, you know, when you're making decisions, the needs of the organization, at least in the military, it has to come first because it's life and death. And then excellence in all you do, you know, do a good job, always do the best. Don't phone it in, so to speak. And I've been, again, coming from my background, particularly in the military, where I was surrounded by people. And quite honestly, as a lawyer, as a JAG, I was in the room giving the advice to people making tough decisions on things, legal decisions and on personnel matters and so on and so forth. So I got to watch how these decisions were made and the ones that were done right and the results, real results. So that's a long answer, but I was, again, blessed that I didn't really run into a case where I had people give me bad advice.
It's funny, when you were answering that, I realized one thing we didn't really touch on was the connection between military history and circus history, which certainly exists in the U.S. And funny to think you also kind of have these crossover worlds in your life still.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's well known that, you know, the German army before World War I was fascinated with the way the circus loaded trains, and they came over to study that. And in the way because the circus in those days was huge. I mean, there were 1,300-1,400 employees. They moved the show every day, 100 railroad cars. That's something that an army might be interested in. And they were. The Kaiser sent folks over to check us out. So there was that connection. The other part of it too is, interestingly, after World War II, with a lot of that army surplus equipment laying around for nothing, for free, the circus bought a lot of it. And if you look at some of the equipment on Ringling Brothers in the 1940s and early 50s, you'll see half tracks, you'll see Jeeps, you'll see all kinds of equipment that came out of the military into the circus because of the, you know, the similarities between that and feeding people. And then, you know, in those days they had thousands of people that had to be fed every day. You know, just the dining operation is huge, and you know, the movement, the trains. So I think, yes, on the logistics side, no doubt there's all these connections.
Brilliant. All right. Our second question, which I feel like you're going to have an abundance of answers for, is for somebody who is an up-and-coming circus fan or already a circus fan, or somebody who's just trying to be a student of circus history. Is there a book or a movie or an artistic reference that you would recommend to them?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Interestingly, there is a book that was written in the 1940s. It's called I Love You, Honey, But the Season's Over by Connie Clausen. And this woman was grew up in Florida, in Sarasota. Her dad was a circus fan. Long and short of it is that, you know, he encouraged her to join the circus, and she went with Ringling Brothers Circus in the late 1940s. And it's a novel, and you know, it's fiction, but it's about her experience on the circus, and she has a romance with someone in the circus. But what's important about it historically is that she did a fabulous job chronicling what happened, what life was really like, you know, during that period. So if you're interested in the circus in the post-World War II era, that's a wonderful book. She ended up becoming a publisher. She worked in New York. But it's a great book. And people who are into the circus from that period always talk about that. And it's true. It's a funny name, I Love You, Honey, But the Season's Over. But it's basically her time on the circus as a young woman in that period, and learning to do web and you know, the bruises and living on the train and all of the behind the scenes stuff that gives you a sense of what the culture was like and the logistics and of course the art altogether. So I'd recommend that book. And you know, as far as a contemporary song or whatever, I think, you know, the movie The Greatest Showman does a great job in capturing a lot of the spirit of, and it certainly is popular now. There's sing-alongs. I think that's, it will whet your appetite about it. Who is this Barnum guy? You know, who are these people? I think that's a nice intro to a younger person to come into it. And then finally, you know, as far as another art form, you know, musical plays, the play Barnum is got some great music in it too, and a little bit of the story of the history. So those three things I'd recommend to a young person or who are kind of interested in the history of the circus to check those out.
Brilliant. I'm definitely going to read that book. I have it on my shelf. I haven't cracked it open yet, but now I have a reason to do so. Okay, our final question. Who do you think we should interview on our podcast?
Oh boy. Well, You know, I'm very honored that you asked me to do this. I didn't expect it because I'm not, you know, in the business. So I'm one of the guys in the seats. But, you know, I think I don't know if you've done it already or not, but I would encourage, you know, some of the people from the circus schools that have a tradition. I don't know if you've asked Troy Wunderly, but he comes to mind off the top of my head. You know, but there are certainly others that understand the connection between the generations, this way to say it. I think that's something that should be talked about. People who are in that business where they understand what happened in the past, but they also know what's going on right now, particularly with young people, teenagers and stuff in this art form. And I think if you haven't done that already, I would suggest that.
It's so funny you say Troy, because there's only three people who I've done episodes with who, after we hung up the recording, the file was corrupted or only my audio was there, or only his audio was there. And Troy is one of them. We recorded Troy maybe a year and a half ago, right before the pandemic. And after recording it, I hit play back and the whole thing was like just gobbledygook, you know, sounding audio. So I'll have to re-record that. But Troy's a great guy, and his story was absolutely fascinating. So
yeah,
thank you for
pushing
that one more time.
Yep.
Bruce, thank you so much for doing the podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope everybody who's listening to this goes and signs up and becomes a Circus Historical Society member. It's very much worth your time and money to do so.
CircusHistory.org.
Perfect. Bruce, thank you so much. And that was our interview with Bruce Hawley.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Also, make sure to get your Reflex tickets. There are only 2 weeks left of in-person shows, plus 1 week of online streaming starting Valentine's Day. So if you're looking for something to get your significant other or the person you love, maybe it's a ticket to Reflex online. You can get your tickets at reflexshow.com.